Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
Hello, Chicago!
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking about the history of college radio with author Dr. Catherine Rye Jewell. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, let's review new music from Alejandro Escovedo and Vampire Weekend. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island since 1988. Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find 312 Weed Ale, Big Juicy Beer Hug, and so many other limited releases at either of Goose's locations in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
That is John Conquest from the new Alejandro Escovedo record, Echo Dancing. John Conquest, you may have heard that song before because it was from Alejandro's 80s rock band, The True Believers, in its original incarnation. A great band.
One of the founding bands of alt-country, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, and they rocked. It was a hard-hitting band out of the Austin, Texas scene. This is Alejandro's 18th studio album. His first in 6 years. He's a guest on the show back in 2008, show 156 to be precise. I mean, he's a legendary figure, a career that stretches back to the 70s, pioneering punk rocker in the U.S., now Americana royalty. You know, the Nuns in San Francisco famously played with the Sex Pistols during the Sex Pistols' final U.S. show. Back in the 70s, was with Rank and File, a pioneering alt-country band, the True Believers, as we mentioned.
Took it even further.
Great band in Austin, Texas. Solo act in the early 90s with a side trip to another punk rock band called Buick McCain, who were really great.
A little glam in them, yeah.
Very much so. A songwriter and a rocker who straddles the roots rock scene, associated with No Depression magazine and alt-country, and also the punk glam scenes with the roots in California, as well as a side trip to New York City, where he stayed at the infamous Chelsea Hotel in the late 70s.
Well, also straddles, Greg, I think, the border that is the focus of so much of America today.
Absolutely.
You know, Mexican, American, Texan, Mexican.
So the new record, Jim, is him reinventing 14 songs that span his career. He basically arranged and produced this record with Don Antonio in Italy. They had worked together on the an album called The Crossing, which, to your point, was about the immigrant experience. You know, both of them, outsiders in their world, you know, based on, you know, here's a Mexican-American punk rocker. Was he fully accepted in that scene? Here's an Italian blues guitarist. Was he really accepted as a blues man? So they wrote about their experiences, and it was a terrific record, and the tour that was planned around that was cut off because of COVID. So they decided, hey, let's do something together, a new project, and they hit upon this one. Here's a track called Too Many Tears from the record. Initially on the 2012 Alejandro record, Big Station, which was produced by Tony Visconti. Here's a new arrangement of that track from Sound Opinions.
I need your hungry tears. It's all I feel. I need your hungry tears. Just a little too much. There's too many tears.
That That is Too Many Tears by Alejandro Escovedo from his new album, Echo Dancing. I love the story, Greg, that Alejandro was literally on the plane to Italy. I'm a little envious there. Yeah. When he decided, I'm not going to record this new set of new songs that I have. I'm going to revisit some of my classics. Now, classic is relative. We don't have an entire career overview. I was a little disappointed. We got nothing from the Nuns
right.
or Rank and File, but we got True Believers, Buick, McCain, solo tracks. And in the great Bob Dylan fashion, you can listen to these songs no matter how well you know Alejandro's catalog. And in many cases, not all, not even recognize the tune.
Right.
He has taken them somewhere far from where they began and somewhere that I love. He has always been a fan of Stooges, both the catchy Stooges and the Funhouse Stooges, of Brian Eno, you know, a name he's dropped quite a bit. And he takes things way out into art rock territory often on this album, you know, just amplifiers that sound as if they are giving up the ghost while he's ringing these, you know, waves of feedback from them. Ambient, distorted backgrounds, strange sonic beds for these tunes, and then also some moments of real vulnerability.
No one to laugh at our jokes anymore. There's a door, don't forget your hat.
Alejandro, we are lucky he is an American treasure, and we're lucky he is still with us. He's had serious health challenges over the years. He only seems to come back stronger, though, and with an unabated 17-year-old, I love making noise, kind of like youthful enthusiasm, you know, to completely reinvent himself and to always go somewhere he hasn't gone before.
Yep, he's a rare gift to music. You're absolutely right about the adventurousness. This record is steeped. I read one interview where he said, you know, the major influences on this record were my time at the Chelsea Hotel, and it was Judy Nylon and John Cale.
Yep.
You know, I mean, he was totally into this idea of disrupting everything we think we know about him and his you know, tremendous career as an artist. You know, but anybody who's seen Alejandro live knows that, like Dylan, he will play extravagantly different reinterpretations of everything in his catalog, as well as the covers that he does. I've seen him do the Stooges' I Want to Be Your Dog with a string section. And he pulls it off.
Cover Street Hassle by Lou Reed.
But, I mean, amazing kind of reinventions of these songs. So this is kind of his comfort zone. He's okay with this whole idea of, like, hey, I want to mess this up, and I want to totally reinvent it. So that's right in the pocket. The one thing I will say about this record, I A-B'd all the tracks, right? I wanted to go back to the originals. Not one of these tracks made me think, oh, the old one's inferior now. Not one.
No.
So I wouldn't say this is like the essential beginning point for a lot of newbies to Alejandro's kingdom, right?
But it's,
you know, it is a perverse way. Alejandro only knows perverse of getting the newbies to go back to his, this is kind of his version of a greatest hits record.
That's probably what it is.
You know?
It's true, but I think you can enjoy this record without knowing Alejandro.
Sure.
And just take it for what this one is.
It's like a movie soundtrack, don't you think? I mean, it's really, that's what it is. It's got that sort of noir feel to the whole record. And it's really cool. It's kind of a mood piece, using his old songs as raw material.
It's just something people say.
That is a little bit of a track called Prep School Gangsters from the new album by Vampire Weekend, Only God Was Above Us. Greg, how could we bump into this segment with any other track? I mean, Prep School Gangsters, I think that's what Vampire Weekend has been trying to portray themselves as since they came together quite some time ago, early 2000s at Columbia University in New York City. From the beginning, Ezra Koenig, lead guitarist, vocalist, force of the band, cute guy in the polo shirt, okay? An amazing rhythm section, drummer Chris Thompson and bassist Chris Bayo. They are now, all three of them, the only key members of Vampire Weekend. In the early days of the band, up to 2016, keyboardist Rostam Batmanglij was a key contributor to broadening the sound beyond guitar, bass, and drum. These days, co-producer on this new album, key player in terms of adding keyboards and other instruments, Ariel Reichstadt. And Ariel's been there for the last two albums, I believe, and has also worked with a really impressive roster of people, Haim, Adele, Solange. They became ubiquitous on the festival circuit. Their output has slowed down considerably in recent years. Now comes album number five. They all live in L.A. these days, although New York remains their geographic and spiritual center. What kind of music is Vampire Weekend giving us in 2024? Let's play a track. The album title's an interesting one, Greg. Only God Was Above Us. Mm-hmm. Who is Mary Boone? Those of you who did not grow up in New York, we're going to play a track called Mary Boone. Used to own a very hoity-toity art gallery. I think I had an assignment back when I was at NYU to go see some art there. I got kicked out because I was clearly not going to spend $750,000 on a piece of art for Mary. Yeah, that's what Vampire Weekend singing about here. Here they are.
Salmon dollars and Natarajas and Hexan bonds, Ando churches and whirling dervishes, long exposures, and these two tunnels go west and east. Let me bring you my masterpiece. You're the author.
That is Mary Boone, a track from the new Vampire Weekend album, Only God Was Above Us. You know, I admire some of this band at a distance. I mean, their ambition in these arrangements, that first track, Ice Cream Piano, I go, if they pack anything more into this, it's gonna burst.
It's a track it's about going everywhere, yeah.
It's about a warring couple, and there's conflict and disillusionment, and the arrangement expresses that perfectly. Those tumbling strings after the first chorus, that flurry of instruments after that, it drops to a near whisper, and then it's back to this flurry, and then there's a guitar ripping away.
The word was weaponized as soon as it had passed your lips.
The dynamics of that push-pull relationship. Yeah, I get it. This is incredibly ambitious and incredibly well done. You know, musically, it's very impressive. I found myself checking out of this album because, as you'd mentioned, the heart and soul of this band all along has been New York City.
Yeah.
And this album is replete with lyrical references to New York City. I spent a half an hour of my life researching Water Tunnel 3 so that I could understand the track Surfer. What is he going on about? I finally figured it out. I did some research. But if you're a casual listener to this track, I dare you to make head or tail out of it. Ezra's a smart guy, right? Lots of tidbits of information floating
about. Ivy League
He's
educated,
an incredibly
yes.
educated man. But man, all of this stuff feels very remote to me. I've always felt this way about Vampire Weekend, that they are brilliant musicians. They make some very, and they're good songwriters, but the emotional connection to these tunes is lacking. He's got something to say, but does he make me care? That's what I want to know. In my case, no. That song, Mary Boone, I'm actually glad you played that because that is the one track that I felt some emotional lift to. The reason for that is it samples Karen Wheeler from a Soul to Soul track. The vocals are borrowed from a 30-year-old record. but it was one of those things like, it's, you know, what is the emotional connection? Again, it was...
The emotional connection is you have to be a subscriber to Art Forum.
And if you're a New York City native and really into it, I guess I could understand.
Even New York, I know. You know, on Gen X Cops, which is getting some attention as the kind of grungiest track here, it's Vampire Weekend does The Strokes. Ezra sings... each generation makes its own apology. I still think, brother, you got to be apologizing for Oxford comma. And you are not going to find two bigger copy edit geeks than me and Mr. Cott. And even we were like, really, this is what you got to sing about? Horchata? Okay, good, all right, fine, right. But the Oxford comma, this guy's a pretentious twit. And their time has passed. Their window has closed. There is no need in 2024 for New Vampire Weekend. It wasn't meant for me. Well, that is what we thought of the new albums by Alejandro Escovedo and Vampire Weekend. As always, however, we want to hear from you. What did you make of these records? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. When we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Catherine Rye Jewell about her new book, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in and inspired by Chicago. They got 312 Wheat Ale, Hazy Beer Hug, and many more one-off beers at the Fulton Street Tap Room or their new Salt Shed Pub, the perfect place to go before a show at the Salt Shed. Me and Andrew were there on opening night, Greg. Mm-hmm. It was really exciting. You had Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, tick fever. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, every time we go to one of these Goose joints, there's another new one to try, and we love them all.
I'm a fan. In addition to making great products and event spaces, Goose Island has always been a supporter of music culture in Chicago and nationwide. I mean, if you see that Goose Island logo at a venue or a restaurant, you know you're in good hands.
Yeah, we are proud to be associated with Goose Island. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer, and Sound Opinions is. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer. And we're back. For decades, college radio was a force of education and community building. But since the advent of the internet, the shape of those stations has changed as we've moved beyond scarcity and further into the age of streaming.
Dr. Catherine Rye Jewell is an historian and professor at Fitchburg State University. Her second book, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio, details the rise, fall, and potential future for student-led radio stations. Catherine Rye Jewell has just written the definitive book on college radio, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Dr. Jewell, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you so much for having me.
I got to start by saying I read the book, obviously, and then I was looking at reviews and I found a brief interview with you with a photo of you in your Vanderbilt University College Radio Day. You were all of my best friends in college. You know, t-shirt, coffee mug,
yeah, right.
Ready to do a DJ shift,
yeah.
At Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
So obviously this was a subject near and dear to your heart, too.
It was. It was central to my college experience. It was a student activity. It was something that I did with my friends, everybody in my dorm. I lived in the so-called freak dorm on campus. Vanderbilt, yes, was kind of a staid student culture, and all the weirdos congregated to the arts and philosophy dorm and to the radio station. And that was where we found each other. And so it was the center of not only this exploration of music, but also my social life in college.
Mm-hmm. That was the late 90s, right?
It was.
So, Catherine, tell us about that experience, because you were on the cusp of the internet era when that started shifting everything and how we consume music. What was it like there? Because the influence of college radio when Jim and I were youngins was just incredibly important. And I wonder what niche the college radio station at Vanderbilt played in terms of exposing kids to music.
So it was a really interesting station because it was a pretty high wattage station compared to a lot of other college radio stations. And it was right in the heart of Music City, Tennessee, Nashville, just down the street from the Grand Ole Opry. And the whole music scene of Nashville was really vibrant. So that station was really important in not just connecting to the local Nashville scene, but whenever musicians would come to town to record, we would usually get artists who stopped by Manor Astroman. I interviewed them on my show, which is a big, I was a little starstruck when that happened, being the indie rock kid that I was. So it was one of these quote unquote free form stations where you could play whatever you wanted, but the ethos of the station was wrapped around this educational identity that college radio had, which was about exposing listeners and the DJs to bands that they otherwise wouldn't be able to hear, and that we were really trying to expose sounds that didn't get play anywhere else. And so I started in 1997, and you know, I was 18 years old. I had no idea about things like the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and deregulation and corporate consolidation in the music industry. I just wanted to play cool music, but I had this sense that something was happening on commercial FM, that we had KDF was the big alternative rock giant. We hated KDF. I didn't really understand why I hated KDF. You know, I didn't really like Creed, which I guess they played a lot of, but there was this antipathy. And so I did develop this sense that we were doing something. We were staking out important musical ground as things were changing. And then, of course, Napster comes along in the midst of my college career.
Yeah, right.
And that all of a sudden, that scarcity mentality that we had around getting access to music. I say this all the time. If in high school, if I wanted to hear Flock of Seagulls and I didn't own a Flock of Seagulls record, right, what are you going to do? There is no. And I think we've forgotten so quickly what that experience was like. And so when I was in college, that shift was rapidly happening. I can remember going down to the radio station and burning CDs and, you know, ripping them onto my computer and just having no compunctions about that whatsoever as well.
Because you weren't going to get that music anywhere else anyway. It wasn't a question of not paying for it and being too cheap.
Exactly. I was in college, you know, it seemed they were $20. That was a lot of money for me. It was hard to get access to. And so there was this kind of sense of opening up, but absolutely no sense of how this was going to change the music industry itself and the position of college radio within that bigger landscape.
Catherine, you hit on this in many different points in the book, but not as clearly as I'm going to say it. There's something magical still about radio, right? When the internet goes out and the big storm is coming, snowstorm, tornadoes, whatever, right? You can still dig out the battery-powered radio, and you know that the DJ on the other end is in your community and is looking out the window at the weather coming in just like you are, right? Or used to be. You know, with the corporate consolidation of Live Nation and Clear Channel and all of that, you know, three, four major corporations controlling so much of radio, one DJ in New York or LA, yeah, you're listening to Hits 101, you know, and it's like, they have no connection to you. College radio was the exact opposite. You know, you knew when the DJ was going for a smoke break or a bathroom stop, because that's when they played Sister Ray or Mushroom by Can, right? But you could call them up and say, I'm here with my girlfriend and it's a special night. Will you play, you know, Big Star for us, right? It was intensely personal. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm talking about my experience in the 80s, right? I didn't go to Princeton University. I had a lot of friends there, and they had nobody else who wanted to do overnight shifts. So I would drive down to Princeton from Jersey City and sit on WPRB and play, you know, Can and Husker Du and the Replacements, Left of the Dial, song that comes up many times in your book. To what extent was that still existent in the 90s, because you were there sort of in the last gasp, and what have we lost today? Have we lost that today?
Yeah, and it gets to this other side of the college radio ethos, which is this community-oriented role that these stations played. And definitely we still had that mystique of radio, of some of it more pleasant than others, of, you know, the local wait staff. I remember at Tin Angel calling in and requesting this song that we had found from the eclectic section at the local thrift store. It was called Pass the Beanbag, and it was quite the hot little ditty on WRVU that we found and would play on our show, and they would call in and request. And there was this real personal connection that we felt.
Yeah.
Then we had our, you know, Crazy Ephraim East Nashville, as he was known as, who would call in regularly as well, which was maybe had a different kind of tone to the relationship, let's say. So we had that local identity of a station, that this was a station that was really shaped by Vanderbilt and its culture, but also the people that we were playing to. And so on the one hand, there's this educational function of college radio, training future DJs, training people in what music is out there, but also serving that community function. And a lot of stations really took that role seriously, even if they didn't have community DJs who played, which we did, which was a big part of why that station was so amazing. We had Ken Berryhill, the world's oldest living radio disc jockey, who started the station when it was a Carrier Current in the 1950s. And he had recordings of, he would pull them up and say, here's me interviewing Patsy Cline outside the Ryman. And he was still playing those tapes in the 90s. And so you got, you know, not just current history, but local storied history of, you know, Nashville's Music Row and the Ryman Auditorium. And every station had that different profile. And that very much still exists in college radio. But I think what we're starting to see is a bifurcation. We start to see a split between the educational functions and the community functions. And one of the bright spots in radio right now is with low power FM. So even though my station WRVU was sold by Vanderbilt, which was just a total tragedy for those of us who,
and that's happened with a lot of college stations.
Yeah, and it has happened frequently. But in the wake of that, there was WXNA Nashville got a low power FM signal, which is a kind of hyper local signal, and then WXOX in Louisville would be another example. And so I think we are starting to see nonprofits and community groups still look to radio to perform those community functions. But these institutions of higher education seem less and less interested in doing that, as we're subjecting these stations and what they're doing, and higher ed in general, to these kind of market tests of, you know, what's the return on this? What dollar value can we kind of attach to this function, or, you know, what job are our students going to get out of this? And I think that's where I get really nervous about what's happening. But I think also that college students are incredibly creative people. And if we give them the space and the freedom to figure out what's next, what the next identity for these signals are, that they're going to be able to figure something out.
Well, and the backdrop for all this, you know, the importance of college radio and community radio, 80s, 90s especially, before the internet made everything accessible to everyone anytime, having this voice in your ear that was speaking to you on a local level, on a micro level as opposed to macro, massive consolidation in the mainstream music industry, where, as Jim was alluding to, you had some guy in New York telling you what to listen to. And it was usually a very limited playlist. There were certain songs they couldn't play. I remember when 9/11 occurred, there was a list of banned songs, like John Lennon's, Imagine. You couldn't play that because it might upset somebody in Poughkeepsie or something.
Yeah.
So massive regulation. Also, words you can't say on radio. Incredible narrowing of the parameters of what could be discussed on mainstream stations. College radio, you could do anything. And some people hated it because it was so chaotic. But in terms of just like having real people talking about real things in real time, it was a lifeline for a small but very dedicated community. You were really kind of the last generation that was really part of that thing now. And, you know, I'm happy to see your optimism about, you know, they're going to figure it out, which you did, your generation did, and prior generations did with college radio. But what do you think is the future of it? Because you're right, college radio is disappearing.
I think it goes back to that question of localism and how do we build community connection from the ground up, and that universities exist within geographic spaces. And I think sometimes they forget that. It goes back to these questions of kind of the political economy of radio and the music industry and higher education, and that behind the business of music, the business of culture, are these institutions that have an interest in knowledge creation and cultural creation, no matter what the market return on it might be.
Right.
But to go back to that idea of it being this magical experience, that there is something about a quote-unquote terrestrial signal that provides a different kind of experience than, as much as I love podcasts, tuning up a podcast or an internet radio station, that there is a kind of liveness, I think, as one radio historian talks about it, that immediacy, that sense that you are listening at the same time as someone else. I think people crave that. I think that's one of the reasons why social media is so contested, but also powerful, because it gives us that sense of we're all responding to and listening to things at the same time. And the more interactive we can make this type of media, even if it's a kind of old-fashioned technology of broadcast radio, I think the more it will fulfill a need that we don't get from our other sources of media. At the same time, and going back to the nerdy side of me, I'm a political historian. And I looked at these stations, not just from a regulatory standpoint, which I did do in the book, but also as a kind of site of these cultural battles over the content of culture. And I was really expecting to go back and see, you know, the green-haired freaks at the radio stations always staking out kind of the most progressive or the most challenging political territory. But really what I found is that these stations, because they had that kind of public forum mindset to them or function to them, they become sites of contest. So if we're looking for those culture wars battles, it's not that kind of top down, you know, FCC coming in and regulating the station. The real tense battles over the culture wars happen laterally among Americans who are much more like music fans than they are like music industry insiders or regulators and politicians. You know, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson get a lot of press about the culture wars, or Dan Quayle railing about Murphy Brown having a child out of wedlock. But the real culture wars are taking place at these institutions at the local level, because we all own the airwaves. They're ours. They're public property. And so even listeners who aren't affiliated with an MIT or University of Illinois or what have you, because they live in that community, they have a legitimate claim to that station performing a certain type of, we'll call it, public service.
Coming up, how college radio stations reflected the communities around them. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And we're back. We're talking with Dr. Catherine Rye Jewell about the community-building power of college radio. Let's get back to the conversation.
You know, I used to rant and rage at Robert Christgau in The Village Voice, dismissing the indie rock scene, fanzines, college radio, indie labels as, you know, white and male, right? And you make the point again and again, some of the biggest support for hip-hop traditionally started on college radio, now the dominant popular music in America. You have Scenes of Common camping out outside WHPK in Chicago to give them his mixtapes, right? And you also have this, you know, bias. The college radio was all, as you said, green-haired, left-leaning, progressive freaks. Excuse me, Steve Doocy of Fox News and Sean Hannity both start out on college radio, which blew my mind, right? But, I mean, it makes sense, right? I can just see the young Republicans on any campus, all eight of them, you know, protesting in the Reagan era or the Bush 1 era. You know, we need equal time, and college radio gave people equal time. Well, maybe not completely equal, but they gave an hour or two a week.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think it's because, you know, we always think of, oh, college radio and progressive radio would be the counterweight to conservative talk radio. And it never really is, because there is no kind of unified audience with one particular political mindset or musical core or ethos that these stations are serving. They're kind of all over the place. And one of the other weird things that happens in college radio is that the participants in them, especially those who are interested in political questions, they often see the radio station as an extension of the classroom. And they kind of forget sometimes that they are broadcasting to a larger audience.
It's true.
Yeah.
You have this little anecdote about Tom Frank and the people from the Baffler at the University of Chicago. You know, the go-to sacred texts commodify your dissent. Any form of genuine youth rebellion is instantly commodified. That upstairs neighbor in Sabalon Glitz you were talking about, Chris Holmes, Greg and I knew him well, right? So here's the Baffler saying, the only legitimate form of cultural revolution left to us is to protest being advertised cultural revolution. And upstairs neighbor Chris Holmes couldn't sell out to the major label fast enough, you know. And he had a show on HPK that was like 3 hours of talk about tinfoil hat, UFOlogy, you know, it was, but with like a political tinge that was sort of pre-QAnon before QAnon. College radio has always been a mess, and that's what I love about it.
That's the best part. I mean, I tuned into, I'm in Boston, so let's just say a prominent university's radio station recently.
And which of 20?
Which of 20? It's a big name with lots of headlines, and it was like 9 o'clock at night, and all of a sudden the music stopped, and then there was about 30 seconds of dead air, And then I could hear somebody whispering in the microphone. They didn't put their mic up. Mm. And I was just like, this is so charming and wonderful. You can't hear this anywhere else. And so that kind of amateurism, I guess, which is sort of a dirty word. But that's what gives college radio that kind of je ne sais quoi of you don't really know what you're going to get. And it can be all over the place. And there were so many good Chicago stories, but you know, you're right about college radio being this really important and overlooked institution in hip hop. There is a whole book to be written just about college radio's role in hip hop, and for better or worse, that there's a reason that it doesn't get kind of swept up into the pantheon because of the kind of whitewashing that goes on of college radio in popular memory, as well as indie rock. But some of that also has to do with the way that the idea of college radio has become a kind of sound and aesthetic. It has been kind of boiled down to this one thing. And I think one of the reasons that you see so many people lamenting college radio's demise is because they're looking at that one narrow identity of college radio and say, well, that's not really there anymore. It's been swept up and taken over by the internet, or Sirius XMU has that sound and I can tune in from wherever. And they miss all of these other things that college radio was, and including training future broadcasters. Yes, I have a photo of Steve Ducey from his college days at the University of Kansas, which that was a find, let me tell you.
You're mentioning this, the power that college radio, that was a section in a record store. It was like, they had, it was college rock, right? That became a thing. You had CMJ, College Music Journal. You know, it started showing up in my mailbox when I was a critic at the Chicago Tribune. And I'm going, this has nothing to do with the Billboard that I'm also getting that week. The Billboard chart is different from the College Music Journal chart. And then I started getting invites to this CMJ festival in New York City. And I started attending that, and I'm running around all these clubs and seeing all these cool bands that nobody had been really talking about in the mainstream. And, you know, you've got that Pixies, charming Pixies poster on your wall there, Catherine. And I remember first hearing them on college radio. The reason they got big was because the college radio was playing the hell out of them and saying, this is a great band. That's how I found out about them, when they were on 4AD getting played on college radio.
It's educational, right?
Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is it had real power, it seemed like. It was influencing what mainstream radio was going to play 2 or 3 years from then, and had real, it had a commercial aspect to it, despite its humble beginnings.
Reluctantly.
Yeah, reluctantly sometimes, because those sales calls started coming in pretty quickly from the majors. I mean, the real irony is that the major label industry almost wrote college radio off in the early 80s. They stopped giving free record service. They were like, this is, as a promotional tool, has no value unless they have a big wattage. But because of some FCC finagling and the role of NPR, college radio stations started to upgrade their wattage in the early 1980s because they get rid of the small licenses, the 10-watt licenses that college stations occupied. So there's kind of ironic harvest of trying to do away with these stations that actually make them more valuable to the music industry. But it comes with it's like a double-edged sword, that on the one hand, we have all this power, we have all this influence, but that means we're now kind of in the spotlight to do that work, to do the next thing, to be the subject of these sales calls. But it's funny you bring up CMJ, Greg, because I visited your papers at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Library and Archive and saw your notes from visiting CMJ. And I think it was 1992, 1998, and 1999. And but in 98, I'm interested in your perspective now. You were talking about nobody knows what's next. That doesn't look like there's anything coming next. And so it seems like that 98 transition moment, really, though, before stations were starting to broadcast on the internet, that it really had more to do with what was going on in the music industry that was reshaping things rather than, oh, look, I got a little thumbs up bubble from my Zoom.
That's the FCC listening in.
They're here. They're saying, yes, yeah. Kate, talk about the industry, not the FCC anymore. But it seems like there were these business transformations happening even before streaming is disrupting. I hate to use that word, but kind of disrupting the business of college radio. And I was able to read your handwriting, Greg.
That's even more remarkable. I used to carry around these reporters' notebooks, and everybody's going, what is this? You know,
they haven't asked for my notes.
It's a language only one person can understand.
All right, Catherine, fighting words. Despite punk rock exploding at CBGB and then New Wave starting from there in New York, you say Boston was much more influential in its college. Now, I know, you know, Radio On, Modern Lovers, 100 colleges and 50 college radio stations. But what do you mean by that?
Well, so first things first, Boston claims to have the first punk rock radio show in the form of Oedipus's show on WMBR station, MIT station. What was interesting about Boston's radio scene is there was enough space for punk to get a foothold. So a lot of stars, what we think of as punk stars now, get on the radio for the first time in Boston. And because there was a little bit more space, more coverage on the college radio stations there, I think there's this interesting competition among the different college radio stations. And there's something about Boston's radio market, maybe not just because of the college thing, that all of these signals are kind of closely crowded together, but they're able to still kind of coexist and carve out their own niche within radio, whereas you don't have that in the same way in other radio markets, maybe just because of the size of Boston, the kind of geographical size. And so you get this interesting layering going on in the radio market where there's a little more space for punk to emerge. I think what is also forgotten about college radio is that in the 70s, a lot of these stations were kind of square.
Well, the professor was tapped to give his lecture on radio after he gave it in class that week. Yeah.
Exactly. And a lot of stations were emulating what AOR was doing because that was new. And so the WBCNs of the world, the freeform rock giants, they were starting to format and narrow their playlists in the 70s. And so college radio stations, they just saw themselves as doing something slightly different, a slight alternative to what was happening on commercial radio. And so a lot of stations would just be playing maybe the next deep cut on the album, next to, you know, whatever Styx song was hitting the charts on the commercial dial. But they were still in the major label industry. They were still playing very similar selections of musicians and artists and genres with a few more things thrown in. So you'd have a jazz show, you'd have a reggae show, you'd have other genres that weren't getting coverage, or you'd have, you know, Italian language news or Haitian Creole talk shows. And so they were anything that you couldn't find in the commercial dial. So when punk and new wave come about, a lot of those AOR types are going, ugh, like, what are these synthesizers? Like, we don't want any of that on our show. And there's real battles. And that really is sort of the battle in college radio. There's a couple of disco flare-ups as well. But really, the battle is between what they called progressive music, which meant new wave, and the AOR. We're just going to play rock, but like a little more deep. And so it takes a while for punk to get a foothold in college radio. And so by the time it does, by the time that gets associated with college radio, it's the early 80s. There's more independent labels. The music industry has rediscovered it as a promotional tool. And now there is actually product out there that is alternative to the major labels for these stations to play. Whereas in the 70s, there wasn't as much.
I want to double back to the discussion about CMJ and the kind of professionalizing of college radio. You know, we had Tim Sommer on last year about his Hootie and the Blowfish book, right? You know, so I went to NYU a year or two later than Tim, you know, and the man hosted Noise the Show, which was him screaming at the top of his lungs and playing 30 one-minute hardcore punk songs in the space of half an hour, right? I loved it. But all of those people, dozens of people Greg and I knew, who'd done college radio in the 80s, wind up as major label employees, publicists, or talent scouts in the 90s, right? Sommer signs Hootie and the Blowfish, you know, and they bought him a gold-plated Cadillac or whatever the hell it was, right? You know, they all sold out. I mean, like Luke Wood at Geffen, who was Nirvana's publicist, right? I mean, how many of those people did we know, Greg?
Yeah, right.
No. And then there were people with ethics, like Naomi just loved doing radio. She left NYU. It was in the music business briefly, or I'm thinking of Bettina Richards, who starts Thrill Jockey, right? Mm-hmm. It was a dividing line. You know, you had to figure out, am I in this for love of music or am I in this for career? And far too many college radio DJs, because I'm a college teacher as well, that I know today are just eager to play K-pop and the Beyonce single. And I'm like, wow, you know, and nothing wrong with either of those things, but you know, they're emulating what's on commercial radio, not realizing there's one DJ.
You're assuming, though, a 19-year-old kid knows what she wants to do, you know, for a living. You know, it's kind of like not that many people are so career-oriented at that age. You know, I would think, at least the people that I came up around, you know, like they didn't know what they wanted to do. The college radio station was just a place to experiment.
Like, yeah, but I'm saying they're not experimenting.
I'm moved, though, like, you know, by stories like Chuck D being a DJ at Adelphi and figuring out what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a playground for ideas, right? I mean, I don't know, Catherine, your experience was, you're a history teacher.
you know,
and you're not. That doesn't relate necessarily to loving the Pixies when you're in college, but I'm sure there's a connection there that, you know, led you where you are. You're still talking about it with incredible passion, enthusiasm.
There is a connection, and I'm glad you brought up the Chuck D example because he encapsulates in a quote that he gave, Adelphi closed his station where Public Enemy quite literally formed, which was a real loss to the hip-hop scene and to Long Island and to the community. But he went back and luckily Adelphi kind of rallied from that. And he talks about how college radio helped him find his voice. And I think in general, we look to these years in college historically as a time to do that, to figure out who you are, what it is you want to do. And you go and get exposed to all these different subjects and questions and you learn how to write papers and you kind of figure yourself out and where it is you want to go. I think the problem is that right now, because of the cost of higher education, because of our kind of general conversations around higher ed, today's college students don't feel that same kind of freedom, that they feel that there has to be an immediate return to this investment and that they don't have the same kind of space to experiment in. You know, I wasn't paid to do college radio. But a lot of my students, they've got to go to work. You know, they got to go down to Dunk's and you know, sling some coffee to make ends meet so that they can eat. They don't have time to go down to the radio station and find themselves through a microphone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real challenge to figuring out what's next for college radio is that these students don't have that space. We don't give them the space. It's like they have to come in as fully formed adults knowing what they want to do from day one.
Yeah.
And that really depresses me. That's where I get very dark my pronouncements for the future. Because Chuck D had access to that real liberal arts kind of exploration, even though that station had a lot of professional journalism students who wanted to gain professional experience on the station, he still had that space to figure out who he was. And thank God he did, right? So that we can have Chuck D's voice out there for us all.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, but the next Chuck D, are they going to have that same space? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
No, I'm seeing a shift in higher ed away from liberal arts and humanities and toward career.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, Greg, these kids are no. You know, and I'd be like, now is the time to make a mess on the page and to burp into a microphone. All right. We've been having this high-level conversation live from the Underground. Is a wonderful historical book. I don't see what is left to cover about the history of college radio, because mm-hmm. you spent 10 years researching this, and the results show.
We've been talking with Catherine Jewell. What a treat. Live from the Underground, a history of college radio. If you wanted to know about college radio, this is the book for you.
And the FCC and corporate consolidation and true context.
Truly. Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.
That wraps up our conversation about college radio, a subject near and dear to my heart. But as always, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org, and share your thoughts. Greg, what is on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to deal with songs about babies. We have a certain person very close to us who's expecting one of those babies in the very near future.
Yes, indeed. Our producer, Alex Claiborne, this was on her mind. I don't even remember this one being floated. It just appeared like, let's do this.
It's a natural. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Max Hatlam, and our social media consultant is Katie Koch.